All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going way back to 1976.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We're going to dig into a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case,
Yeah.
Commonwealth v. Osero.
Sounds interesting.
It should be. We've got a lot, actually. The court's opinion, obviously, a good case brief, some background analysis.
Okay.
It's pretty clear there's some pretty major legal issues that all kind of come together in this case. So that's what we're going to try to figure out. You know, expert testimony, what the prosecution have to do in terms of sharing evidence, how juries are supposed to be told what to do, and then this thing called the deadly weapon inference.
Yeah, I've heard of that one. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But first, I guess we got to lay out what happened, right? What are we actually talking about?
Absolutely, yeah. So this case really gets to the heart of some like core legal principles. You know, what evidence can a defendant even bring to court? What does the prosecution have to tell the defense? How does a jury know what to do when they're deciding a case? And maybe the biggest question, how do we prove someone meant to do something, especially when we're talking about serious crimes?
Right. So I guess let's start with the basics. Roy Osero, right? He shot and killed a guy, right?
Yeah.
During an argument in a restaurant.
That's right.
So open and shut case, right?
Well, not really. It's more complicated than that. I mean, Osiris said he was acting in self-defense, and he also claimed that the gun went off by accident.
Okay. How'd that happen?
Well, he said he had a heart condition, had surgery for it before, and he was worried about having a heart attack during the argument. And then someone, he says, grabbed his hand while he had the gun out, and it just, well, went off.
Okay. But the prosecution obviously thought differently.
Oh, yeah. They went for premeditated murder, first degree murder. You know, they thought he planned this whole thing.
And what'd the jury think?
The jury sided with the prosecution, found him guilty of first degree murder.
Wow. Okay. So, end of story.
Well, as you might imagine, not quite. Osero appealed the verdict, and he had like four big legal arguments he was making.
Oh, okay. Let's hear him.
So first, he said the trial court messed up by not letting him bring in a psychologist to testify.
Okay.
Second, he claimed there was a Brady violation, that the prosecution hid evidence from him, his coat specifically. Then he had an issue with how the judge told the jury to think about his testimony. And last, he argued that the jury wasn't given the right instructions about what accidental killing means.
Okay, that's a lot. Let's take it one at a time then, starting with the psychologist. Who was this guy, and what was he gonna say?
The psychologist was a guy named Dr. Pizzat, and his testimony was supposed to back up Osiris' claim that he didn't actually intend to kill the guy. Well, you know, Osiris said he was scared of having a heart attack. So Dr. Pizzat was basically gonna say, yeah, that fear makes sense, and it explains why Osiris even had the gun out in the first place, and that this fear supports the idea that the shooting was an accident.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So why didn't the court let him testify?
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court agreed with the trial court on this one. They said, basically, that having an expert come in just to say a defendant is telling the truth about how they were feeling, that's stepping on the jury's toes. The jury is supposed to decide who to believe, not some expert.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess. It's their job to figure out who's being honest, right?
Right.
But wait, didn't we talk about a case? Commonwealth v. McCusker, I think it was, where they did allow an expert to testify about the defendant's mental state. So how is that different?
Good catch. Yeah, that's a really important point. The difference is the kind of mental state they were talking about. In McCusker, the expert was talking about something really unusual, something most people wouldn't understand without an expert explaining it. But in Osiris, the court said, look, fear of a heart attack, that's a normal human emotion. Everyone understands that. You don't need a psychologist to tell the jury that someone with a heart condition might be scared.
So it's like the expert is only allowed to testify if they're explaining something the jury wouldn't already know.
Yeah, basically. And that's important because it protects the jury's role. They're the ones who decide the truth, and the court doesn't want experts taking over that job.
Interesting. Okay, let's move on. What about this Brady violation? What was going on with Osero's coat?
Okay, so Osiris said the prosecution didn't give him his coat back and that the coat would have helped his case.
How?
His argument was that if they had the coat, it would show the gun wasn't easy to get to in his pocket.
Okay, and how does that help him?
Well, it could make his story about the accidental shooting more believable. If the gun was tucked away and hard to reach, it seems less likely he was planning to use it, you know?
I see. So what'd the court say about that?
They weren't buying it. They said even if the prosecution did keep the coat from him, it wouldn't have changed anything.
Why not?
Because, they said, the coat only really tells us about how he was carrying the gun, not about whether he meant to kill the guy.
Right. It doesn't really prove intent, I guess.
Exactly. And remember, with a Brady claim, the evidence has to be two things. Good for the defense, and it has to be important enough to potentially change the outcome of the trial.
So the court's saying the coat just didn't meet that second part, the materiality part.
Right. They said it was too minor of a detail. Like, yeah, it might be interesting, but it wouldn't have changed the jury's decision.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
So what was next? Oh, yeah, the jury instructions, the stuff about Osero's own testimony. What was wrong with those?
Well, that's where things get a little tricky, procedurally speaking. You see, Osero's lawyer, apparently he didn't say anything about the jury instructions at the trial. He didn't object. And this is important because right before this case, Pennsylvania got rid of what they called the basic and fundamental error rule.
Okay, what was that?
It basically meant that even if a lawyer didn't object to a big mistake during the trial, the appeals court could still look at it and possibly overturn the verdict. But now that rule was gone. So since Osero's lawyer didn't object to the jury instructions when they were given, the Supreme Court said, sorry, we can't even consider that argument now.
So it's like if you miss your chance to speak up at the trial, you can't complain about it later.
Pretty much, yeah. It's a lesson for all the future lawyers out there. If something seems off, you got to speak up right then and there.
Yeah, makes sense. The judge can't fix it if they don't know it's broken, right?
Right.
Okay, last issue. The instructions on accidental killing. What was Osero's problem with those?
Well, he wanted the judge to tell the jury about accidental killing in a very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge didn't do it exactly like that. They kind of, you know, changed the wording a bit.
Okay, but was the change a big deal?
The Supreme Court didn't think so. They looked at what the judge told the jury and decided it was fine. They said it explained accidental killing in a way that was good enough, legally speaking.
So even though the wording wasn't exactly what Osero wanted, it still got the point across.
Yeah, that's basically what the Supreme Court decided. They figured the judge has some wiggle room in how they explain things to the jury as long as they're not changing the basic legal ideas.
Gotcha. Okay, I think we've hit all the specific arguments Osero made, right?
We have.
So now we can get to the big one, the deadly weapon inference. This is a big deal in Pennsylvania, right?
It is, yeah. It's been around for a while, and it's basically a rule that says if you use a deadly weapon on a vital part of someone's body, the jury is allowed to assume you meant to kill them.
Okay, makes sense, I guess. If you stab someone in the chest, it's not exactly an accident.
Right. And Justice Nix, who wrote the majority opinion, he even quoted a line that kind of sums it up. One does not really use a deadly weapon on a vital part of another's body unless they intend to kill.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. But the court took this inference even further, didn't they? It wasn't just about intent to kill. They said it could also prove premeditation for first-degree murder.
That's exactly where things get really controversial, because first-degree murder, you need more than just intent to kill. You need willful, deliberate, and premeditated killing.
Right, so like planning, thinking it through beforehand.
Exactly. And the majority opinion said basically that the act of using a deadly weapon on a vital spot, that alone can sometimes be enough to show that kind of planning and premeditation. The idea is, if you choose to use a deadly weapon like that, it implies some level of thought and decision-making.
But not everyone on the court agreed with that.
Right.
Definitely not. Justice Mandarino wrote a dissent, a pretty strong one, where he basically said, hold on, using a deadly weapon might show you wanted to kill someone, which is enough for second degree murder, but it doesn't automatically mean you planned it out beforehand. He thought there needed to be more evidence, things like a motive or signs of planning or something specific about the situation that shows it wasn't just a spur of the moment thing.
So he's saying there's a real difference between wanting to kill someone and actually planning it out.
Right. He was worried that if they just rely on this inference, it basically erases the line between second degree murder and first degree murder.
Yeah, I see what he means. It kind of lowers the bar for proving the most serious kind of murder.
Right. And remember, first-degree murder carries a much harsher penalty. So Mandarino thought the prosecution should have to show more than just the way the weapon was used.
Didn't another justice, Egan, I think, also have some problems with this inference?
Yeah. Justice Egan agreed with the majority overall, you know, upholding the conviction and all that. But he did add a little note saying, look, while the inference might be okay for proving intent to kill, be careful about using it to prove premeditation. He thought there should usually be more evidence, not just the weapon itself.
So even though he wasn't completely against the inference, he was still a little cautious about it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. He wasn't ready to throw out the whole idea, but he definitely thought it should be used carefully with other evidence to back it up.
Gotcha. Okay, so this has been a lot. What are the main things we should take away from this case? Especially for, anyone out there listening who's interested in law.
Well, I think there are a few big things to remember. First, the jury is the boss when it comes to deciding who's telling the truth. Experts can't just come in and say, believe this guy, even if it's about their mental state.
Right, the jury has to weigh all the evidence and decide for themselves.
Exactly. And second, procedure matters. You have to follow the rules, make your objections at the right time, or you might lose your chance to argue about it later.
Yeah, a little mistake can have huge consequences, right?
Absolutely. And then, of course, there's this whole issue with the deadly weapon inference.
The big one, yeah.
It's still a major part of Pennsylvania law, and it shows how powerful that inference can be. Using a deadly weapon on a vital part of the body, that can be enough to prove intent to kill. And in Pennsylvania, it can even be enough to prove premeditation for first-degree murder.
Which, as we saw, not everyone agrees with.
Right. Justice Mandarino's dissent really highlights the potential problems with relying too much on that inference. It raises the question of whether we're blurring the lines between different levels of murder, between a heat-of-the-moment killing and a planned one.
And for our listeners, especially those studying criminal law, it's really important to remember that first-degree murder needs both intent and deliberation. And Osiro shows how Pennsylvania law, through this inference, can use one action to prove both of those things. It's a pretty powerful tool, and it's still being debated today.
Yeah, for sure. And it shows how much weight courts give to the decisions made by trial courts and juries. You know, they're the ones on the front lines, hearing the evidence and seeing the witnesses. Appellate courts are generally hesitant to overturn those decisions unless there's a clear error.
Okay, so to wrap this up, I think the big question is, what does all this mean for how we define and prove intent in violent crimes? It's a tough question trying to figure out what was going on in someone's head during a violent act.
It really is. And Osiris gives us a lot to think about in terms of how the law tries to deal with that complexity.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for today's deep dive into Commonwealth v. Osiris. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
See you then.